Chrisanne, thanks so much for joining us today on Face the Facts.
It's my pleasure. I'm so happy to be here with you, and hi to everybody out there.
So this is your first time on the show, and you know, I wanted to bring you on to talk about a topic that I can't find many other people talking about, and that is the case of what's going on at SCOTUS regarding social media and censorship, and of course, the attack on free speech that we've seen increasing over the last couple of years. So tell us exactly, you know, what happened. And then we can kind of go into why are we in this crisis that it seems like we're in America today, where laws get passed that we feel like are against what should get passed, and you know, help us understand what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So this week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on a case called Murthy v. Biden, which was formerly known as Missouri v. Biden. And it Louisiana also filed a similar case. And it has to do with the discovery that the FBI was actually sending frequent and strongly worded emails to social media regarding COVID and the censoring of viewpoints during COVID. And one situation was actually pretty egregious, was there was evidence that because of the FBI's strongly worded and persistently sent emails, that an advocacy page on Facebook was shut down. A very important advocacy page on Facebook was shut down right before an election, which they actually have evidence that had a palpable effect on the outcome of that election, not on the election of a person, but on an issue that was on the ballot. And so the oral arguments are what happens when someone appeals all the way to the Supreme Court, a lower court's opinion. And then both sides, the Biden administration and the attorneys for Missouri and for Louisiana, present their arguments before the Supreme Court. And they're live. You can listen to them live while they're happening. They're live streamed. And I like to listen to them, especially when it comes to issues that affect fundamental rights. This is a freedom of religion issue. This is a freedom of speech issue. This is a freedom of press issue. This is a right to peaceably assemble issue. And this is even an issue about petitioning government for a redress of grievances. So this case actually encompasses all five liberties that we find in the First Amendment. So this is actually a very, very important case. And I say that unfortunately, because after listening to the oral arguments, and sorry, I didn't, you know, I mean, the eye roll almost comes in reflexively now. I was not very encouraged by the arguments that I heard from the justices regarding the government issues of our free speech and the First Amendment and the government's limits on their activity that restrains or coerces our freedom of speech and all those other rights. It was very frustrating because as a constitutional law attorney, I've actually practiced this area law since 2007. I was a prosecutor and I've been actually working in the legal field for 24 years. No, wait. Yeah, for 24 years. So almost 25 years. And so it was kind of frustrating to me because there were some very specific constitutional arguments that I didn't hear. And so I was yelling at my computer while it was happening and yelling at the justices while it was happening because it was very, very disturbing.
And what were, give us an example. Questions.
Pardon?
Yeah, give me an example of what was frustrating you.
Well, I actually put a post up on Instagram that was, I labeled the top five most disturbing takeaways from today's oral arguments. And I will say that the most, one of the most disturbing aspects of those top five things that I have is that this wasn't just reserved to what we would generally classify as the liberal justices, right? Mm-hmm. So this was a majority. Amy Coney Barrett was arguing the same arguments that Brown Jackson was arguing, that Sotomayor was arguing. We didn't hear much from Justice Thomas, which is typical. And Kavanaugh and Alito, I think that Alito was more on a defense of rights argument, but didn't really say a whole lot. Gorsuch is always a pro-liberty, pro-rights person, limited government. He's really the only solid one we have on the Supreme Court that stands for everything that is constitutional. He has some issues with other things, but he will always defend states' rights. He will always defend the liberty of the people, especially when it comes to First Amendment issues. He talks about the right to keep and bear arms. He's very pro individual rights. Roberts was a little bit hard to judge, but to my humble opinion, was leaning more towards Coney Barrett's argument, which all of those were: Roberts, Barrett, Brown Jackson, Sotomayor, and why does that happen? I just forget their names. Anyway.
Thomas, did you mention Thomas?
Kagan.
Oh, Kagan.
Kagan, yeah. We're all making the most ridiculous arguments. For example, certain circumstances exist that give the federal government a duty to shut down viewpoints of their choice to protect the public and to stop discourse, public discourse that they think is dangerous to the public.
And that's incredibly scary. It sounds like a yes. Marxist regime.
Oh, it is extremely scary. Now, it's just extremely scary to say out loud, but it's even scarier to realize that these Supreme Court justices were talking about it as if it was mainstream accepted standard. That the federal government has a duty to keep the people safe. They actually said that. Well, we all know the federal government's duty is to keep people safe and protect the people. Well, in that point, I really want to say, if I were that justice, or if I were that attorney, I would have to say, you know, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. And as evidence of that, we can look to the oath of office, which the oath of office says that we will support, protect, and defend the Constitution.
Exactly.
Not keep people safe. Because our founders were very adamant, and they said over and over again, people quote Benjamin Franklin at this, but I can show you a dozen or more instances where a dozen or more different people said the same thing, but in different ways, that if you trade liberty for temporary security, you have neither.
Yes.
And so you have this situation where the Supreme Court justices are embracing as a mainstream narrative that if the government actually perceives an emergency, that their preferences, their desires, and in just a second I'll explain to you that they even believe the government has rights that supersede ours. One of my favorite quotes in that line comes from a British parliamentarian who was always standing on the side of the American colonists for independence, first for the American colonists to actually have the rights of all Englishmen in Parliament, which the English government was denying of these citizens. But then he supported their independence because the British Parliament and the British King were not going to give the American British colonists their rights. And he said, necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants, and it is the creed of slaves. Now, his name is William Pitt the Younger, and that was in 1983. I'm sorry, 1783. And so we have to understand that our founders lived in the midst of many emergencies. As a matter of fact, during the ratification, the writing and the ratification of our Constitution, our American colonies were going through an actual pandemic, not, you know, the...
Right, not the plandemic.
Pandemic, right, but an actual pandemic. And in the midst of an actual plandemic, a pandemic, our founders never gave the federal government authority over our health, our health care, or an emergency of our health. That was never something that was delegated and could have very well been delegated because it was a very hot topic at the time.
Yep.
So this whole argument is just extremely, extremely upsetting. They also said that the FBI is allowed to make strong and persistent suggestions to private entities to
stop. Meaning like scare them into compliance.
Right. And the most ridiculous thing that I heard, see, you get it, right? You get it. In constitutional law, there is a long-standing principle called the chilling effect.
Yep.
And in constitutional law, the government is not allowed to even do anything that could possibly chill, right? Real aggressive, I guess the thing would be the heat of public discourse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the chilling effect is anything that the government does that makes you go, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. And that's the standard, right? So never once in this oral argument did I hear anything about the chilling effect of the FBI giving strong and persistent email communications to shut down this public discourse. As a matter of fact, I heard the opposite. I heard Supreme Court justices giving the most ludicrous, hyperbolic scenarios, right? Hypothetical scenarios. Well, what if someone has classified documents? Doesn't the federal government have the authority to shut down the classified documents being spread across the internet? Well, maybe so, but that's not what happens here. You know, I get really upset with these hypotheticals that they allow the justices to chase down this rabbit trail, and they never say, you know, with all due respect, we have an issue here at hand that's egregious enough. The hypotheticals don't really apply here. Can we please stick to the situation that we have at hand? Because the Supreme Court is actually limited in its judicial authority to only discuss the matters which are presented via appeal. They're not allowed to take in new stuff and make this up as they go along. They're really bound by this is what was appealed, and they do it all the time. They say, like, I'm sorry, was not argued on appeals, so we can't handle that. But here we are in a situation where it becomes clear that these justices want to be activist judges.
Yep.
So they start stepping outside what are clear boundaries since the creation of judiciaries, right? So the justices kept saying, well, these emails don't really sound threatening. Coney Barrett was like, she actually said, well, did they actually threaten? Do these particular agents have the power to come through with a threat? What was their authority to do that? And I give props to the attorney arguing on the Murtha side, right? The Louisiana Murtha side, Missouri Louisiana side said, you know, it doesn't really matter whether they had the authority, you have to understand there's a perceived authority. I mean, if you get a call from the FBI, if you get an email from the FBI, the average American and the average business owner is going to be like, what the crap?
Oh, it's going to scare them to death or scare them into compliance.
Exactly. Regardless of whether they have the actual authority to carry through any threat, regardless of whether they said, if you don't do this, we're going to shut you down. Right.
Well, just take
strong language that was read into the record was over the top for the chilling effect. Right. Because that's the standard. Would this have caused a reasonable person enough concern to say, well, maybe I don't want to tangle with the FBI?
Look at how successful they were in the entire J6 scenario.
Yeah.
Right. People who went to redress their grievances.
Right.
Who just showed up in D.C. are in jail or being charged, or scared that any day the FBI will knock on their door because they were just in the vicinity of the Capitol on that day.
Well, and that was the whole purpose of the way that Marxist hammer fell on the people who were just simply there. I mean, we have record of people simply flying into Dulles that day being subpoenaed and questioned by the FBI, not even actually being at the Capitol, but just flying into Dulles at that time.
Right. So here's the thing. This is what we're up against right now, is that it seems like lawlessness continues to win, and things that don't make sense or in years past would have never warranted this type of behavior are now it's being steamrolled into society. And we have justices, as you mentioned, that are more concerned about being activist judges than truly upholding the law. But if you could help us understand, why are we at this place right now in America where this is what it is? You referenced it earlier when we were speaking about, you know, in the mid 1800s, there was a shift that happened. I think it's so crucial for people to understand this.
Yeah. So in 1828, if you Google this, you can see the history. There was a period of political history called the Great Tariff Crisis of 1828, which led into a period of 5 years. That blends all into what we call the nullification crisis of 1833. And so what happened was that Congress had passed a tariff that was contrary to the Constitution's general welfare clause. Now, back in 1828, 1830, we still had an accurate understanding of what the General Welfare Clause meant. Today, we are taught the General Welfare Clause is sort of a blanket for the federal government to do whatever they want, you know, whatever is good for the general welfare of the people, which is completely erroneous. So the General Welfare Clause was an instruction to the federal government that whenever they engage in power that was delegated to them, that they had to exercise that power for the general welfare of the union, meaning they couldn't favor one state or another or one region over another, right? Because the union was formed, as the Articles of Confederation referred to them, as a mutual agreement of friendship for their mutual benefit. Right. So the General Welfare Clause was an expression of the federal government's requirement to act for the mutual benefit of everyone. Right. Not just favoring one over another. And these tariffs strongly favored the northern states and heavily detrimented the agricultural southern states. So the industrial states of the north were favored highly with this tariff monetarily and in international market, while the southern agricultural states were really hurt, I mean, monetarily in a very large way. So several of the southern states said, you know, this is a violation of our agreement in the Constitution, and we're not going to impose these tariffs down here. We're not going to do it. Well, Congress, and Andrew Jackson was president at the time, Andrew Jackson got his panties in a wad, and Congress got all upset that these states were exercising their right to refuse to comply with orders of Congress that were unconstitutional. Well, Andrew Jackson went to the nth degree and threatened to send troops into the southern states to take control of the southern states and enforce this tariff. And we were, you know, I mean, this is 1828. We're barely brand new and we're about to bust wide open. So, to sort of shorten up this long story, Congress said, okay, we'll meet with these states. We've decided we're going to repeal this tariff and we're going to reissue a tariff that's more fair in everyone's eyes. And then Andrew Jackson, you know, st stopped bullying the people and said, I'm not going to send troops in. Well, this whole scenario, which actually worked the way the Constitution was designed to work, because our Constitution was designed so that the states would be a very powerful external check and balance on the federal government they created, because the states created the federal government as a representative of them in foreign affairs. And so all the framers who ratified the Constitution realized and accepted the fact that the states were remaining sovereign and that they would have this check and balance over the federal government. But there was already a heavy nationalist, globalist movement, even back in that day, that said, you know what, we're never going to be able to accomplish this globalist goal if we have 50 independent, or we have independent countries who build up this union exercising power on the federal government. So we have to change that. Now, they couldn't amend the Constitution to change that because that would take three quarters of the states to do that. And there was no way they could do that. So what they did was they had a Supreme Court justice by the name of Joseph Story to write a treatise to educate lawyers, judges, and the general public on how the Constitution is to be applied. Joseph Story's treatise was printed in 1830, and that began our fundamental transformation of how the American public, via the politicians, the political scientists, the law schools, the judges, the lawyers, all began to apply brand new principles that I refer to as federal and judicial supremacy. So prior to Joseph Story's treatise on the Constitution, it was never believed that the Supreme Court was the ultimate arbiter of what was constitutional and what was not. It was never believed that the states must blindly submit to every demand of the federal government. It was never accepted that the Supreme Court was created to be an oligarchy to rule over the people or the states. Those things were actually contradicted in the Constitution and in the text. Prior to Joseph Story's treatise, there was a treatise written by one of the men who helped write the Constitution. His name is St. George Tucker. So it's not like we didn't have an instruction manual on how the Constitution was supposed to work. But what they did was they pushed aside St. George Tucker's understanding. I mean, he was there. He knew this. He helped write this. He wasn't on the Continental Congress, but he was involved in this and he was there, was living it. And they pushed that aside and started pushing Joseph Story's reformation of our understanding of the Constitution. So now we have the idea being taught in our law schools and in our colleges, and even now, K through 12, right? That the Constitution is a living, breathing document. It doesn't really mean what it says, and it's a racist document, so you can't even follow it anyway. The Supreme Court is the supreme ruler of the universe. And all of that has led to these erroneous beliefs that the president has all this power, which he does not have, that Congress can pass any law that they want when they have a majority, and that when the Supreme Court issues an opinion, it's actually a ruling that nobody can disagree with.
It's egregious to see that what has happened, and truly for the next generation of kids that are raising up and learning this, it's scary. I know that you have tools to help people understand their constitution and their rights, and you have a fantastic course that you offer on your website for that. But I'd love for you to just tell us a little bit too about what's going on with the bars that the lawyers, have to go through to get their legal certifications, because even those have been captured. And if you don't mind just sharing a little bit about that, because I think over the last couple of years, people, we had so much faith and trust in the legal system, and we've watched that erode, much like our trust in the medical establishment and so many other things, right, where our eyes are being opened. But tell us exactly a little bit about what you're seeing as it refers to the bar.
Yeah, sure. So I'll just say libertyfirstsociety.com is where we have a online learn at your own pace curriculum. We go through all of these things. I mean, we have dozens of online classes, and I don't teach like, a law professor from a law school where you just hear from the lectern and it's boring and it's just case law and it's Latin and all that. One of the things that I really enjoy doing is taking these complex issues and breaking them down so that everybody can understand them, but keeping the depth at the same time. So I taught a Supreme Court justice at the state level in Texas, who told me he learned more from me in an hour about the Constitution than he did in his entire legal training. And that same class had sixth graders in it that said, wow, I really understood. I learned what was happening. So one thing that we have to understand as a people is that we've been bullied by the academic elite forever to think that it's impossible for you. You're too stupid to be able to read the Constitution and know what it means because it's all these hidden meanings and all this other stuff. That's just ridiculous. It's not. I mean, it was written so that the average layman in 1783 could read and understand it, without Google. So that's what's crazy. So libertyfirstsociety.com, and I'm really happy to announce the coming of our homeschool program. The website for that is connecthomeschool.org, connecthomeschool.org. So we're going to be doing homeschool legal issues. We're creating a curriculum that you can trust from a history government perspective. All my training going K through 12, right? In a way that parents can trust and give it. We do original text only. We even have character building classes called Story Time with Dr. Hall, where I'm reading stories that I grew up with, like, the Little Red Hen and the Little Engine That Could.
Oh, these
things that built character that we don't get anymore, right?
Yep.
And so if you go to connecthomeschool.org, you'll see there's a video. It's a brand new site, and we're going to be launching this curriculum in July before August school starts. So get signed up there. Get your email signed up and be on the forefront of that. But it's important for us to, as you said, to address your question, it's important for us to know, right? It's absolutely important for us to know as individuals, because we can't trust the education system. Cannot.
Yeah, absolutely. It's why my husband and I homeschool and have actually for over 10 years.
Oh, yeah. My son's 18 now. He's not in school, but we've homeschooled him as well.
Yeah.
And in that homeschool journey, as Christians, we discovered even the Christian curriculum out there, especially in history, is just simply the same curriculum pulled out of the public school systems, Christianized, right? So it's just, I can't tell you how many Christian homeschool curriculums I've taken in history and just crossed through it to the point where I said, to my son, you're not learning from these books. I'm going to teach you. This is just garbage, because they have co-opted our history because they know that dictates our future. Right.
So true. Yeah.
So you had mentioned that we used to trust the medical system. We used to trust the legal system. I would simply say, I'm not sure if it was trust, but I think for a very long time, we've convinced we've had no other options. And that's part of the silencing of the other discourse.
Well, and I think too, so many companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just watched, I started to not trust the education system when my children were born, and I began looking into the types of things that were happening and who was being appointed on the Board of Education under the Obama administration, things like that. But the majority of parents did not wake up to this until 2020 and 2021 when they started.
One of the best things that happened because of COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that is the silver lining in a horrific circumstance. And so, but what I'm saying is it's a relatively short period of time for people to start to pay attention to what their children are learning and also not learning in right. schools. So we've only really seen such a boom in the homeschooling, you know, community in the last 3 years, which is wonderful and exciting. I think there's something like up to 7 million families now are homeschooling across the nation, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I think as a Christian, I like to really remember and repeat to myself the principles and the truths that I find in the Bible. One of them is despise not the small beginnings. And that's what we're seeing. And that's just a reminder to me that, you know, change has to begin somewhere. And we have to realize that as a matter of human nature, we always see it as somebody else's fight until it comes home to us. And it's come home to us. And so we see parents all the time. I mean, we have hundreds of parents who are signed up at libertyfirstsociety.com, teaching their middle schoolers and their high schoolers the truth about American history, about government, about civics, and those kind of things. And now with our homeschool program, connecthomeschool.org, we are wanting to bring everybody in because, like you said, you're a homeschool parent. We're homeschool parents. There's really no reason for us to be frustrated with our curriculum choices. There's really no reason why we should be left wondering, can we trust this or not? And so that's why we've put this together to give parents a confidence, because here's the bottom line. If we remain with the status quo, even, you know, those of us who are fighting for the school boards now, we're fighting for education now, if we don't rescue our children from this system now, when we're too old to do anything else, they'll turn the whole system back to where it was before we started, because that's what they've been taught. So we have to be very vigilant. We have to be diligent. And we have to realize that it's going to cost us something, right? It's going to cost
100%.
Us time. It's going to cost us resources. And we're going to commit to do things that are important. So many times your parents say, well, I have to work. Well, I don't have the money. Well, if it's a priority, you'll make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but when we started homeschooling my son, we began realizing that and I'll say this very boldly, by the way, the propaganda that mom and dad have to work outside the house is completely false. It's really an invention post-Civil War to actually keep the revenue stream of income tax flowing into the federal government. Because remember, prior to the income tax, prior to the Civil War, there are no real working women. I mean, there were women who owned businesses, you know, but it wasn't a common thing. And it wasn't because the women were oppressed, mind you. It's because women took their role of mother, wife seriously and realized that was a job in and of itself.
Exactly.
I mean, today, can we be totally honest and say that that role never went away? We just have to be corporate mom 8 hours a day. Then we have to be wife, you know, 12 hours a day. We have to be mom 24 hours a day. So we just added more burdens on ourselves. And the whole thing was set up so that the government could continue a two income stream in the household. So when we stepped back and reprioritized how things worked in our household, we realized that our children were the most important asset in the family that deserved every level of sacrifice necessary, which included keeping the home and that sort of thing. But maybe it doesn't mean you have to have a 6-bedroom home in an affluent neighborhood for 3 people. You know, you live within your means, because the most important thing is who will your child be as an adult. And so as
I love to hear you say this, Chrisanne, because I feel like I'm talking to my new best friend, but this is literally this has literally been my mantra for my husband and I since we had our babies, is, you know, we didn't have our children for the government to raise them or for anyone else to raise them. We had our children so that we could instill those values in them and, you know, impart and disciple them in the Lord and who they are. And look at the attack on the identity that has happened in this generation. And I really think that, you know, when you look at when you compare a child who's been home educated to a child who's been in the public school, you not only see the stark difference in just how they interact with adults, because typically homeschool kids will look at an adult in the eye and speak to them with, great diction. And, you know, it's not the same. And again, I'm not trying to make a blanket statement on everyone, because I know there's a lot of great kids too. But in general, you can tell the kids who have been brought up in their home with their parents, you know, actively engaged with them.
It's not just a blanket statement. It has become a societal expectation. Ivy League schools now more heavily recruit homeschool students than they do, public school students. Industries look for homeschool students. The military prefers homeschool students because they're independent thinkers, they're self-motivated, they're articulate, they're smarter. I mean, it's just a crazy thing. Let me ask you a question. You've ever heard parents come to you and say, well, I'd like to homeschool, but I'm really worried about how my child will be socialized or lack socialization?
I love it when they say that to me.
I do too.
I love it. I say,
no, that's why I'm not putting my child into government school, because I don't want my child socialized like that.
1,000%. Do you want your child to learn how to behave based off of other children their age who knows what they're exposed to, what they're looking at online,
the devices?
Well, right now we know now, but back in the day when we were just starting this whole thing out, I mean, I think iPads were just becoming a thing. My kids were maybe 6 or 7 when iPads came out, and I just was shocked at the amount of parents who would just shove an iPad in front of their 2-year-old. And I just thought, wow. And I've seen a quote recently of just, you know, if you really want to take away your child's childhood from them, give them a phone or give them a device, and it's gone, because that's then all that they want. But I love it when people say that comment about, socialization, because the ones who are home educated typically are extremely, as you said, articulate and can have great conversations. And they're learning behaviors based off of what their parents are modeling, not what their peers are modeling.
Well, I can tell you, as a lawyer and watching the legal trends happening with government and government schooling, I could never, ever send a child to government school anymore as a parent, nor could I advocate for that. There is a legal doctrine that began in the mid-70s called in loco parentis, which is Latin for the parent in the place. And it began with, again, remember that quote I gave you of William Pitt the Younger, the emergency, right? So you send your child to a government school and the parent's off working. What happens, right? The hypotheticals, and maybe even real situations. What happens if the child has a medical emergency and the school can't get in touch with the parent? Well, the school doesn't have a legal authority to seek medical care, to make medical decisions for the child. That that didn't exist. Until the schools and the government argued, well, we're the parents while they're here. So we assume certain emergency powers, right? I mean, we will obviously do our best to get in touch with the parent as soon as possible. We'll be continually trying to do that. But while the child's life in danger, we're the parents while they're here. So we get to make these decisions. And that's what has snowballed into the current understanding of the school is the parent when the child is at school, and the parent is the parent when the child is at home. You're literally co-parenting with the government if you send your child to a government school, because that's what the law says you're doing. That's why now the public schools think in many states and many places that the guidance counselors can talk to your kids about stuff you're not allowed to hear about. They're allowed to put your kids on medication you're not allowed to object or sometimes even know about, because when your child is in that government school, and Loco Barreta says they're the parent and you're not. And that
it's so scary. I mean,
slope is growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, I mean, look at all the times we've heard over the last couple of years how teachers would even refer to that child as someone of the opposite sex, that of the gender that they were actually born in, and you're not allowed to tell the parents that this child is in effect transitioning during school.
Right, because the school is the parent and you're not. And so, I mean, if we're, I am under the firm understanding, this is not a belief, this is not a theory, this is not a guess. This is a legal understanding. If we are going to be parents who really want I'm trying to use the right words, because the public school system was built by Marxists. So it's not really doing anything. It's not broken. It's working exactly the way we want. It was designed to work. So if we really want a public school system that reflects the ideologies of the parents and not the ideologies of Marxist government, we're going to have to eliminate in loco parentis as a legal doctrine in the schools, because everything else is just simply going to fall to the wayside as soon as they can come up with an emergency that says we need to be your child's parents right now.
Well, I mean, even look at what has happened in the schools with the mass shootings, where there's been shooting incidents and parents are not allowed to go in and get their children. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah, stop me. Yeah, no.
Exactly right.
They'd have to shoot me in the back to stop me from going in and getting my child. There's no
way. I mean, that right there, I remember when my boys were little, they were maybe 6, 7 years old, and there was a shooting that had happened. I think it was Sandy Hook. Mm-hmm. And the thought or the idea that I couldn't go and get my child when I wanted, I was like, there's no way. There's no way I would be okay with that.
No way. No way. Well, and you know what? That's the other thing. You know, I don't have to worry about my child's safety when I'm homeschooling.
Exactly.
Because so that's where they are.
Yeah. And I love this topic, but I wanted to get back to the discussion about the bar, because as a lawyer, right? Like all of these up and coming lawyers or people who want to be a lawyer, it's kind of concerning. It's not kind of, it is, it's very concerning to see what's happening in the legal system, and why is this happening, and what exactly is the disconnect? Why are we witnessing, it just seems like in every aspect of society now, the American values which we were founded upon are being diminished and eroded.
Yeah, I think you have to understand the history of the progression, right? So the legal field, like the medical field, was never a field relegated to the classroom. It was more heavily a field that was managed through apprenticeship, right? Obviously, you had to study. You had to study how to do law. You had to study the laws. But the majority of that studying was done via apprenticeships. So the idea of law schools, the idea of bar associations is a relatively new thing here in America, and even in England, because it was a matter of of, well, I would say the bar associations dictating who gets to practice and who doesn't, right? So it was a matter of apprenticeship. The law schools weren't the law schools that you know today. And so all of these things were done in a way to, and I don't want to sound, I know this sounds really sort of conspiracy, but we have to understand there was nothing wrong with the way it was working before, was given the excuse of, well, we need to standardize this. We need to have a mechanism of control and governance, right? So if we create these law schools, we get rid of apprenticeship, then we standardize the practice of law. If we create these bar associations, then we regulate the practice of law, and you won't have immoral lawyers, which is the big propaganda about every form of regulation. Because just like laws don't stop people from committing crimes, regulations don't stop immoral people from being immoral. It's all a fake. It's all a premise and a problem, a solution looking for a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what we most people don't realize is that the Bar Association is not a state entity. It is a non-governmental organization, an NGO, that is full of bureaucrats that are not elected by the people of that state, who literally get to decide who's allowed to practice law in the state or not. So you have the whole guise of, we need to regulate the law, legal field, so that we can punish bad lawyers. Well, the state's not even regulating it. It's an NGO, a non-governmental, non-profit corporation that's dictating who gets to practice law and who doesn't. Now, let's remember then, what does the practice of law actually affect? Well, the practice of law affects the laws that are written. The practice of law affects how we govern. The practice of law affects politics and elections and who we elect and why we elect them and what we elect to do. So we have literally, I don't know, I'm probably going to get disbarred for this conversation, but it's the truth, you know, and that's why we're supposed to have freedom of speech. But the truth is, we have a private nonprofit organization in every single state with the power to dictate laws, politics, elections, and government. And now all these NGOs are just woke leftist Marxist organizations that are bent on ending discourse and anything that actually is opposed to or different from what they want people to know. So you have to teach people that they're too stupid to read the Constitution. You have to go to our law schools, learn what we say about the interpretation of the Constitution. You have to go to law school. You have to go to college, where they teach you that the president is actually a king and he has all this power. So we elect a president to control our taxes. We elect a president to control our treaties. We elect a president to declare war. We elect a president to handle immigration. None of these things are presidential powers. None of them. The president, the executive branch is the president's branch. The executive branch doesn't have the authority constitutionally to regulate the environment, regulate health, regulate air, regulate products that we eat, breathe, ingest, whatever. None of this is the authority of the federal government. But because of the education system that we have been trained into, all controlled now by these nonprofit, politically motivated organizations that dictate what law and politics are.
What would you say to someone listening that says, you know, I've wanted to be a lawyer my entire life? What would your recommendation be for, you know, reputable schools to go to? It's getting slimmer and slimmer, the list.
Well, remember, part of the problem with the bar exams is the schools have to teach the test.
Mm-hmm.
right? Because the test determines whether you get to practice law or not. So if the school you go to is actually teaching the truth about the Constitution, teaching truth about American history, you'll fail the bar exam. So you have to understand that this control that we're talking about is really great. I mean, not great from good, but I mean, extremely powerful. Right?
Yeah, it's massive. Mm-hmm.
So a school who wants to be good can only be as good as they want their students to pass the bar exam.
This is a very scary thought.
It is. It is. And that's what happens when we regulate industries. Because regulations, again, do not stop bad people from doing bad things.
Yep.
Regulations just simply create powerful control. And from the EPA's perspective, powerful control by the government. But if you really understand behind who's pushing the EPA, it's also these non-governmental organizations, right? So all these NGOs push all of this stuff, and they're all politically motivated. So my suggestion, and my suggestion is to anybody who wants to go to a law school is please, because I learned after law school, right? What I learned, what I teach about the Constitution, what I teach about American history was the result of me discovering on my own that I'd been lied to in law school and getting really upset about it. And you know, the inner rebel in me saying, hey, we're gonna do something about this, right? I'm gonna get the truth, and then I'm gonna tell people, whoever will listen to me, I'm gonna give them the truth. So my advice is, please do go to law school, because we need good, educated, moral lawyers. But you must go into law school, every single law school, I don't care what it is, understanding that you're not going to be taught the truth about the Constitution. You're not going to be taught the truth about the limited powers of the judiciary. You're not going to be taught the truth about the powers of government. You're not going to be taught the truth about even how the Constitution was created and the power of the states and the ultimate overriding rights of the people. You're not going to be taught that. You're going to be taught the opposite. So if you're going to go to law school, and I want you to go to law school, if that's what you've been called to do and you have a strong desire in your heart, you have to learn the truth on your own. Do
well,
what
Christine,
you have to do to get through law schools. Give the teachers the answers that they want. Give the bar the answers that they want on the exam so that you can go in and turn the system upside down from the inside out. But we need lawyers with this information on the inside so that we can have legal arguments that will actually make an impact and change the precedent that we operate under.
Chrissanne, thank you so much for joining us today and for all the wealth of information that you're providing to the public. Tell everyone where they can go find you. And also, again, it's libertyfirstsociety.com, correct?
LibertyFirstSociety.com is our online education hub. We have ChrissanneHall.com, which is my name, which is everything that we do. You can even catch my social media there. And then our brand new launch of the homeschool program. It's a whole connect with co-ops in your state, connect with other homeschool kids, get a curriculum you can trust, raise godly, morally motivated adults, and actually get legal help and complying with your state's laws on homeschooling. And that's at connecthomeschool.org, connecthomeschool.org.
Chrissanne, thanks so much for joining us. Hope you'll be back again sometime to talk about more cases as they develop.
Oh, I'd be happy to. I will agree that I really enjoy it. Talking to you, and it's so encouraging and so refreshing to me to find a mom who thinks like I do.